Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release, in which we learn about the early stages of King Asvapati's yoga. And we had reached page 12, and we stopped at line 385. No? Different class. Page 32, sorry, it's my eyes. Page 32, but I think I'm right about line 385. This line 385 refers to the state which King Asvapati is experiencing when he has reached a place where world was into a single being wrapped and all was known by the light of identity and spirit was its own self-evidence. There all the truths unite in a single truth and all ideas rejoin reality. And there he sees the figure of wisdom, supernal, all-seeing, motionless, sovereign and alone. In that realm, knowledge needs not words to embody idea, and idea seeking a house in boundlessness, weary of its homeless immortality, asks not in thought's carved brilliant cell to rest, whose single window's clipped outlook on things sees only a little arc of God's vast sky. The boundless with the boundless there consorts, while there one can be wider than the world, while there one is one's own infinity. So that is what Asvapati experiences. His center was no more in earthly mind, and he's caught up into a vision that surpasses form, into a living that surpasses life. So this leads him to experience a leisure, a moment of leisure, of pause in the labor of the worlds. It is not only for himself. He feels as if all the labor of the universe pauses, a pause in the joy and anguish of the search, restored the stress of nature to God's calm. Nature is always moving, always involved in effort, but beyond that is the original calm of God. Asvapati experiences that a vast unanimity ended life's debate, as if everything in life is a kind of a debate, a discussion going on, a presentation of different views, even of quarreling. Well, but in that state he has experienced now, all those oppositions and differences of nature are resolved in harmony. A vast unanimity ended life's debate. And the next lines, in the next lines, he lists some of the things that have ended, that have ceased. Would you read, Franz? Line 385. 86, bottom of page 32.
The war of thoughts that flutters through the universe, the clash of forces struggling to prevail, and the tremendous shock that lights a star is in the building of a grain of dust. The grooves that turn their dump and inch in space, loud by the seeking of the world's desire, the long,
regurgitations
of time's flood, the torment etching, the dire force of lust that makes kinetic the earth's balanced slim slime, the carves a personality out of mud, the sorrow by which nature's hunger is fed, the
estrus
which creates the fire of pain, the fate that punished virtue with defeat, the tragedy that destroys long happiness, the weeping of love, the quarrels of the gods, feast and the truth which lives in his own light. His soul stood free, a witness and a king.
Thank you. So these are all things that ceased when he experiences this self-evident truth of the Spirit. And as a result of that experience, his soul stood free, a witness and a king. So what are these things that cease? The war of thoughts that fathers the universe. The idea that war is the father of all things. It's one of the dicta of the Greek mystic philosopher Heraclitus, about whom Sri Aurobindo has written a small book. It's the idea that everything in this universe has been born by friction of one kind or another. And here, Sri Aurobindo says this is a war of thoughts, for maybe thoughts of the creative powers, the gods. This clash and friction has led to the creation of this universe. There's also this clash of forces. He says these forces are struggling to prevail, each one wants to be the strongest and overcome all the others. And he says they are prevailing in the tremendous shock that lights a star as in the building of a grain of dust. These are forces of nature which physicists and cosmologists have become aware of too. And then he speaks about grooves. Nowadays we don't use gramophones, but we used to have gramophones and vinyl records, and you'd put the needle in the groove and the record would turn round around and we would hear the music. He says the grooves that turn their dumb ellipse in space, he seems to be referring to the orbits of planets, of galaxies, turning, they are turning, and it's as if their path is determined. There are grooves that they have to follow, grooves in space-time, perhaps we would say now. No? He says here that those grooves are plowed, they've been created, gouged out by the seeking of the world's desire. The whole universe is in search of something, and it's that longing and search which is creating these grooves, the long regurgitations of time's flood. Regurgitation is when you vomit your food out. So it's as if time is absorbing things, and then after a long time spewing them out again. That also ends. And then he speaks of the torment, the terrible pain and suffering, which is edging, giving a keen, sharp edge to the dire force of lust, that fierce longing that wakes kinetic, dynamic in the dullard slime of earth. It seems that the first life forms may have emerged in slimes and mud, in forms of matter that were a little bit more plastic and flexible than minerals or a rock. He says, shapes. So he says that when this life force wakes up from the mud, it's full of this lust, of this craving to experience, to be, and that causes pain. Elsewhere in this poem he has said that pain came first, afterwards delight and pleasure. So this wakes up in earth's dullard slime, its unconscious mud, and carves a personality. It's that urge, that drive of desire that forms personalities in these material forms. But that lust also ceases, the sorrow by which nature's hunger is fed. The estrus, the creative urge, which creates with fire of pain, it's also painful. All these are aspects of the stress of nature. There is the fate, the determinism that punishes virtue, good, correct behavior with defeat. We can't understand why that should be so. The tragedy that comes and destroys long happiness. The weeping of love, the quarrel of the gods, of the cosmic powers. All these things ceased in this vast unanimity, and Asvapati's soul stood free of all those stresses of nature, a witness and a king, a ruler, not just an earthly ruler, but a ruler of himself and his environment. Yes, Audrey. I believe it's the urge to creation, yes. Am I right? Anybody knows better Greek than me? Can't hear you. Ovulation, it's used in a physical sense of a woman who's ready to be fertilized, to prepare to give birth, yes. Or in animals also, estrus. They come into estrus. They're ready to be. Yes, thank you.
Actually, Boisterbos is me.
Yes.
Which is a gadfly that he ascends to Io when Zeus falls in love with her. Yeah. And to hide her from Hera, he changed her in a cow.
Yes.
And then she gets pestered all the time by this fly.
By this gadfly.
Then she crosses the street between Europe and Turkey, the Bosphorus.
Yes.
That's why the Bosphorus is called Bosphorus. That means
because the cow pestered by the cow.
She gives birth. Plato uses it for the desire soul.
Plato uses this term for the desire soul, yes. Thank you.
I don't want to say all these things.
Yes. But it's connected with that legend of Europa and the bull. Am I right?
No, it's
not something else.
Io.
Io. Okay.
She's one of those terrestrial ladies with whom falls in love Zeus.
The king of the gods. Yeah. One of these weird Greek legends. Yes. So here we could say that it's the creative force, or it's the desire soul, which Plato used it for that. Yeah. Thank you.
Maybe I ask something, because here sometimes we don't listen to one. We can say the line that we are talking about, because if we don't listen, we can look in the book. Yeah? Thank you.
Okay. So the word we were talking about was estrus. So have you found it, line 197? Yes, okay. Yes, if you mention the number of the line that you're asking about, that will be helpful. Yes, thank you. That's it. Some people are using books which don't have numbers. Then you can read out the whole line. At least we can do our best. Yeah. Shall we go on? Jocelyn, you would read? Thank you. So this is a result of that freedom. Asvapati is no longer absorbed. The moment-ridden flux, the flow of time on which the moments ride as if on the current, on the surface of a stream, and where mind is drifting on that flow of time. It's drifting as on a raft. If you're on a raft, you can stay on the surface, but you can't steer very well. You just get carried along by the flow. You get hurried from phenomenon to phenomenon, from one happening, one event to the next. He's no longer in that state. Asvapati abode, he could remain at rest in indivisible time, in which there's no division between past, present, and future. Earlier we were told that he owned the house of undivided time, but this seems to be a step further. It's not that time is undivided, it can't be divided. He's seeing the wholeness of time. And as a result of that, he can see past and future and present as if a story long written but acted now. In his present, he held his future and his past. And in each of the seconds, he felt the uncounted years, all the years of time. And it's as if he can visualize the hours one after another like dots on a single page.
He had seen them, but he was not involved.
Yeah, he's just watching them.
Long written but acted now.
Yes. Yes, it has been written long, long ago, and now it's being acted out. But he's watching all that.
Yes, but he's not watching nothing.
No, he's not watching nothing. He's watching what is happening in the flow of time, but he's not in the flow of time. He's not carried with it. He's standing apart and observing it. That is one result. The next line is line 411. Somebody will read that. Okay. Where are we? Amitoj, would you read line 411? Thank you. Asvapati is seeing an aspect of the unknown reality which he hadn't been aware of before. And now when he sees that aspect, the meaning of the cosmic scene of the whole universe of appearances is altered for him. He sees this huge material universe as a small result of a stupendous force, an enormously powerful force. And then there's a colon which suggests that the next two lines are connected with that aspect of the unknown reality. This eternal ray of life which is lighting up that aspect, it illumines not only the past and the present, not only the huge material universe, but that which never yet was made, what has not yet been manifested, the power of thought in the face of this experience, it just lies down in a mighty voicelessness, an enormous silence. The toiling thinker, the mind, widened and grew still. And in that silence, wisdom transcendent, the supreme wisdom beyond the borders of the creation, wisdom transcendent touched his quivering heart, his human heart. His soul could sail beyond thought's luminous bar. The idea of sailing beyond the bar, it comes from sailing. The sailing ships would try to find a shelter in a harbor, and the bar is the borderline between the sheltered harbor and the open ocean. So when you sail out in your little boat, you leave the protective walls of the harbor, cross the bar, and there you are out on the open ocean. So it's as if thought is a kind of limiting, protecting formation. He can move out beyond that. Mind screened no more, the shoreless infinite. He sails out beyond mind and thought into the unlimited, infinite ocean. Mohri, would you read? Line 422. Thank you. We know from one of Shervindor's letters that this line, beautiful line, a last glimmer and drift of vanishing stars, that he has taken this image from the great Sanskrit dramatist Kalidasa, whom he admired very much. Kalidasa uses a similar image about the dawn. In the dawn light, we may glimpse a last glimmer and drift of vanishing stars. As the light grows brighter, we don't see the stars anymore. Here it's as he embarks on this infinite ocean, there's this void, empty sky which seems to be ever retreating. He glimpses these few vanishing stars. The stars are symbols of the many truths. Anyway, the light is getting brighter, and he is able to get a glimpse of those super conscient realms of motionless peace, where judgment ceases and the word is mute and the unconceived lies pathless and alone. What has never been conceived by mind. At that height there comes no forms, no voices rising up from below. In that state, there only were silence and the absolute. Bessie, would you read the last lines?
Out of that stillness, mind newborn arose, and hope, truth, once inexpressible, and forms appear dumbly significant, the seeming thought, the self-revealing voice. He knew the source from which the spirit came. Movement was married to the immobile past. He plunged with roots into the infinite. He based his life upon eternity.
Thank you. In the spring of 1969, when Mother was meeting a few Aurovillians twice a month in her room, she always invited them to enjoy a bath of silence. So it seems that this experience has given to Aswapati's mind a bath of silence. And out of that stillness, the mind comes as if newborn, waking up to truths that formerly would have been inexpressible, unable to be expressed or grasped by the mind. And he sees forms that have a significance. They don't speak, but they express a significance. Yes. Dumbly significant, yes. So the forms don't speak, but they can convey a message. They can speak of some significance. And now the mind, the newborn mind, can understand that significance which is being expressed by those forms.
Is it still the cosmic mind? Or?
Don't ask me. A seeing thought, it says. So it's a thought that's combined with vision and a self-revealing voice. There's a voice, and that voice doesn't have to explain things. Just by what it utters, something is revealed of its essence. So as a result of that experience, Asvapati becomes aware of the source from which his spirit came. He knows his origin.
Isn't that what we are reading?
Sorry?
Isn't that what we are reading? The perception of the world of somebody who is being transformed.
Yes. Yes.
That's what I understand.
Yes. And Sri Aurobindo's conveying as much of that to us as we are able to receive. So when he becomes aware of the source from which his spirit came, then the movement of the universe, this universe of movement, is married, it's connected, united with the immobile vast. He sees the connection between the transcendent state and the universal state. And he's able to plunge his roots into the infinite. We read about him being a skyward being. Where is that? A skyward being nourishing its roots on sustenance from occult spiritual founts. That is how he characterizses King Asvapati at the beginning on page 22, line 30. A skyward being nourishing its roots on sustenance, on nourishment from occult spiritual founts climbed through white rays to meet an unseen sun. So this is the point in his development where he's able to do that, plunging his roots into the infinite. He based his life upon eternity.
So then, this could be a sign of witness consciousness you develop through Raja Yoga?
Well, he mentions the witness, no, that his soul stood free, a witness and a king. Yeah, yeah. I said that this first section, up to page 145, is giving a summing up in essence of the nature of King Asvapati. Then the next section, page 26 at the break, begins, as so he grew into his larger self. What is described in this second section is his development towards that essence which has been described in the first section. And now as we move on to the third section, after this experience, powerful experience we've just read about, Sri Aurobindo tells us that only a while at first these heavenly estates could endure. This is not a permanent realization yet. These are at this stage that we are reading about now, at first, yes. Only a while, at first, these heavenly estates, these large, wide, poised upliftings could endure. That is what happens to us, perhaps. We may go and concentrate in Matri Mandir and reach some wide, uplifted state, but then we have to come down again. And that's what Sri Aurobindo describes next why that happens and why that has to happen. Tuan, you like to read?
Sorry, what page you say?
We are on page 34 at the break. The first section.
Yeah.
That means from the beginning of the canto on page 22 up to line 145 on page 26. There's a break there, no?
Yeah.
These sections, actually, I'm learning that these are really significant.
Mm-hmm.
If Sri Aurobindo makes a division like this, it has a meaning. No? Each of them. Of course, even within the sections, he arranges the lines in paragraphs, and we can find the transitions from one to another. But each of these sections has a topic. We haven't read yet. Ahead of this, we haven't read. Okay, that's very good. Let's pause here, and we'll read the next section, which runs to page 38. Top of page 38. So, starting from page 34, line 437. Tuan, would you read, please?
Only arrive at first these heavenly states, these large white parts uplifting stood in view. The high and luminous tension breaks too soon, the body stark stillness and the life's hushed trance, the breathless light and calm of silent mind. How slowly they fail as sets a golden day. The restless members tire of peace, the nostalgia of old little works and jobs that need to call back small familiar selves to treat the accustomed and inferior way, the need to rest in a natural pose of form as a child who learns to walk can walk not long, replace the tight and will forever to climb on the heart's altar, dim the sacred fire. The no pool of subconscious thoughts renews. It draws the unwilling spirit from the heights of a dome gravitation drags us down to the blind, driven inertia of our base. This tool the supreme diplomat can use. He makes our fall a means for greater rise. For into ignorant nature's gusty field, into the half-hearted chaos of mortal life, the formless power, the self of eternal light, follow in the shadow of spirit's descent. The twin duality forever one chooses its home mid the tumults of the sense. He comes unseen into our darker parts, and curtained by the darkness does his work, a subtle and all-knowing guest and guide. Till they too feel the need and will to change.
Thank you. Karen.
All here must learn to obey a higher law. Our body's cells must hold the immortal's flame. Else would the spirit reach alone its source, leaving a half-saved world to its dubious fate. Nature would ever labor unredeemed. Our earth would ever spin unhelped in space, and this immense creation's purpose failed till at last the frustrated universe sank undone. Even his godlike strength to rise must fall. His greater consciousness withdrew behind, dim and eclipsed. His human outside strove to feel again the old sublimities, bring high saving touch the eternal flame, call back to its dire need the divine force. Always the power poured back like sudden rain, or slowly his breast the presence grew.
Thank you. And take the whole number. Patty, line 492.
A unit of the real with the unique, a gaze of the alone from every face, the presence of the eternal in the hours, widening the mortal lines half the wrong things, bridging the gap between man's force and faith, made whole the brightness being we are here. At last was one affirmed spiritual poise, a constant lodging in the eternal's realm, a safety in silence and array, a settlement in the immutable. His heights of being lived in a still self. His mind could rest on supernal ground and look down on the magic and the play where the God-child lies on the lap of night and dawn, and the everlasting puts on time's disguise. With the still heights and human troubles death, his equal spirit gave his vast ascent. A poised serenity of tranquil strength, a wide unshaken look on time's unrest. Based on experience with one unaltered peace, indifferent to the sorrow and delight, untempted by the marvel and the call, immobile it beheld the flux of things, calm and apart, supported all that is. His spirit's stillness helped the Korean world.
Thank you. Jerry?
Inspired, my silence and the closed eyes sighed. His force could work with a luminous art, new luminous art, on the crude material for which poets made, and the refusal of inertious mass, and the great front of the world's ignorance, and nation, matter, and the huge arrow of life, and the sculpture chisels a deity out of stone. He slowly chipped off the dark emblem. Line of defense of nature's ignorance. The illusion and mystery of the inconscient, that whose black ball the eternal webs his head. That he may act unknown in cosmic time. The splendor of self-creation in the peace. A transfiguration in the mystic depths. The happier cosmic walking, working could begin. And fashion the well-shaped in him new. God found in nature, nature fulfilled in God. Already in him he was seeing the task of power. Life made its home on the high tops of self. His soul, mind, heart became a single cell. Only life's lower reaches remained in him.
Thank you. Larry?
But there too, in the uncertain shadow of life, there was a labor and a fiery breath. The ambiguous, calm, celestial puissance work, watched by the inner witnesses, moveless peace. Even on the struggling nature left below, strong periods of illumination came. Lightnings of glory after glory burned. Experience was a tale of blaze and fire. Air rippled round the argosies of the gods. Strange riches sailed to him from the unseen. Splendors of insight filled the blank of thought. Knowledge spoke to the inconscient stillnesses. Rivers poured down with bliss and luminous force, visits of beauty, storm sweeps of delight, raining from the all-powerful mystery above.
Thank you. Mr. Morty?
Then spoke the eagles of omniscience. A dense wave was rent, a mighty whisper heard.
And so we can go back to page 34, line 437. Devin, you'll read.
Only arrive at first in these heavenlier states, these large, light voice of things could endure. The high and luminous tension breaks too soon. The body's stone stillness and the light hush trance. The breathless mind and calm of silent mind. For slowly they fade as sets the golden day. The restless nether members tired of peace. A nostalgia of old little works and yours. A need to call back small familiar selves. To tread the accustomed and inferior way. The need to rest in a natural pose of thought. As a child who learns to walk and walk not long. Replace the tightened will forever to climb on the heart's contour in the sacred fire. An old pull of subconscious cords renewed. He draws the unwilling spirit from the heights, or a dull gravitation drags us down to the blind-driven inertia of our days.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about these lines?
So that line 404, the restless nether members tired of peace.
So members means our limbs, and nether means lower. So the lower parts of our being are restless. They'll keep quiet for a little while if we put a strong will on them, but they get tired of peace. The body needs to move. The mind starts to get, the vital starts to want to move, no? So that's what causes the high and luminous tension to break. Well, you may have reached some high state, but it's not accepted by the whole being. So after some time, there's a little revolt below.
The feminine page number 445 is also connected with that. We need to call back small familiar cells.
Yes.
All the small parts in us, we call
yes.
the small cells.
Yes. Our normal ways of being, no, different ones. Yeah. And he says, this is the need to rest. Mm. They can't keep up that high and luminous tension. Mm. So it's when we start on this path of experience, it's like a child when he's just learning to walk. He can't walk long before he needs to lie down or fall down.
Mm.
Yes. So, those things, those needs and nostalgias and so on, these things replace the aspiration of the soul, the Titan will forever to climb. It doesn't want to come back, no? And on the heart's altar, there's that flame of aspiration and love. But it gets dimmed by these other impulses. And it's as if, as our spirit soars higher into those higher levels of experience, it's still tied to the lower levels. There's those cords connecting us with the restless nether members. So they start to pull. And that drags the unwilling spirit from the heights. Oh no, those guys again, they're pulling me down. Or, he says, instead you can think of it as a kind of gravitation. You may be able to leap very high, but you'll have to come back to the blind, driven inertia of our base. That's his description of the most physical parts of our being.
He's also telling here that we really start to walk when we pass this stage. No, we are still learning.
No, still learning.
A little bit we can walk and bump again in the old habits,
yes.
Old way of
yes.
seeing. But the next line I do not understand very well. that is at 450. Yes, 449. Replace the Titan
will forever
Titan
to
will means what?
It means that perhaps our spirit has a superhuman will, a strong will that wants to climb forever, but it's not able to sustain that. It gets replaced by these other impulses. And perhaps there's something a little bit arrogant in that will, that, oh, now I'm going to soar off and not come back again.
That's the character of the Titan. That's the character of the Titan.
Yes, Titan, it can just mean oversize or superhuman, no? But it can also mean
something
egoistic that doesn't take consideration of other needs.
Mm-hmm. I feel it is that in us which is unbreakable actually, which is always there and push us forwards, the soul forces or whatever.
Yes.
Titan will, even we go down, but we look for something higher.
Yes.
Still.
But then it's very interesting what he says next, where, if you may remember, let's read the next bit. Achitra, would you read? Line 455.
He makes our form a means for greater rise. For into ignorant nature's gusty field, into the half-ordered chaos of mortal life, the formless power, the self of eternal light, followed in the shadow of the spirit's descent, the twin duality forever one, chooses its home with the tumults of the sense. He comes unseen into our darker parts, and curtained by the darkness, does his work. A subtle and all-knowing guest and guide, till they too feel the need and will to change.
Thank you. So when we get dragged down to the blind, driven inertia of our base, something from the higher levels follows. The formless power, the self of eternal light, follow in the shadow of the spirit's descent. And that twin duality, forever one, chooses its home mid the tumults of the sense, all the disturbances of our sense being, our life being. The self of eternal light, the consciousness, and the formless power, these two are one, chittapas. So they say, yes, we will live there in the physical body. So that one comes unseen in this way into our darker parts. We don't notice him coming, curtained by the darkness. He does his work. A subtle and all-knowing guest and guide within us, until all these darker parts also feel the need and the will to change. And this is because everything here, that's at the next couple of lines, all here must learn to obey a higher law. It's not only the soul and the spirit. All here must learn to obey a higher law.
That's why it was at the end very short.
Yes.
Because that line comes down to
yes.
illuminate the both of
yes. Yes, our body cells.
He says it beautifully.
Yes, he says it so beautifully, no? Our body cells must hold the immortal's flame. Otherwise, the spirit would reach alone its source, leaving a half-saved world to its dubious fate.
He has a logic in a poetic form, which is indescribable.
Yeah.
It's really,
yes.
It's a whole trip on itself.
Yes, exactly. So if this didn't happen, later on he calls it this oscillation. This oscillation between swinging between earth and heaven. Through that, in Aswapati, grows in him like a waxing moon, like an increasing moon, the glory of the integer of the soul. It has to be a growth, a natural growth, but this is how it happens, through this oscillation.
Imagine myself.
Yes. Yes. She was conscious of all that. And later on she said, you know, that the full transformation depends on the proportion of the cells that accept. So those restless nether members, they have to be given their due attention. But perhaps that can only be done after you've reached a certain stage. Aswapati, we've just seen him, that he's had this release, that he can stand a witness and a king. He's had this experience of mindlessness. He knows the source from which his spirit came. He's seen the connection between the transcendent and the universe, and he's able to plunge his roots into the infinite and base his life upon eternity. So that's already a stage which has been achieved. Yes, Mila.
Well, maybe certain something new attitude for everyone.
Hmm. Duality? No, duality only suggests two poles. And here he says these two poles are twins. Actually, twins are always two poles. And these two are the same. And he tells what they are. He says they are the formless power and the self of eternal light. So one is the conscious self and the other is the force. This is the consciousness force of the mother. This is the supreme consciousness force which accepts to make its home here amid the tumults of the sense, all the stormy reactions of our lower being. Is it clearer now?
No, I was thinking a different idea. I was thinking for me, it represented like the duality between our normal lives.
Yes, and through that link, the chaos can get transformed. Yes.
And we accept more of our chaos because it's the one or the other reality.
Yes, yes, that's right. We don't have to deny these lower parts. Only they have to be transformed. They have to be accepted because it's all forever one. Yes, exactly. Thank you. Shall we stop there for today? We'll listen to Mother reading some of these passages.
And all the poor of the conscious cause of endure the unwilling spirit from the type or a dull gravitation drags us down to the blind.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.